Welcome. My name is Bruce Sommer. I'm the Director of Economic Development and Innovation at UIS. We intend to bring experts in to talk about, in this particular series, the Community Health Roundtable series, how the impact of COVID is on our community. And if you think back to when we started these in March, when the stay-at-home order came out, never did I think that we'd, by January, have a discussion around the vaccine. So I am so thrilled that we're able to do that. Without further delay, I'd like to introduce our co-host here, Molly Lamb, the director for the Center for State Policy and Leadership.
This one's exciting because we're not only talking about the vaccine, we're talking about vaccination, and we're at a pivotal point in the pandemic. We'll start with Dr. Sundaresan. She's a full professor in the Department of Internal Medicine and co-chief for the Division of Infectious Diseases at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. She's the program director for Infectious Disease Fellowship Program, and she advises the Sangamon County Department of Public Health. She's going to focus on the medical aspect of the vaccine. From IDPH, Illinois Department of Public Health, with us today, Heidi Clark. She is the division chief of infectious diseases at the Illinois Department of Public Health. She's helped lead the COVID-19 vaccination planning and rollout. And she's done a huge effort on contact tracing statewide and also with the Restore Illinois plan. And then we're going to have Brian Churchill join in on us as a panelist in the public health and healthcare preparedness and response realm. He is the EMS coordinator and emergency management facilitator at St. John's Hospital at HSHS for about 22 years. He serves as the coordinator for Region 3 Regional Hospital Coordinating Center and is the president of the Springfield Regional Response Coalition. Dr. Meneese joining us. He is SIU's System Executive Director for Diversity Initiatives. He's a retired emergency physician, a retired pastor, and in 2019, he received the medical school's inaugural Equity Award. And he's going to focus in on the impact of COVID-19 on disparate populations and vulnerable populations, specific to the African-American population. So I'm going to turn it to Dr. Sundaresan. She's going to focus in on vaccine for us and talk us through the two vaccines that are available from Moderna and Pfizer, the status of the other vaccines that are coming that could be approved, and let us know why they are safe and their efficacy.
I'm going to start with the vaccine tracker. The New York Times has it online. We have 68 vaccines which are actually currently in clinical trials. That's really good news. And I want to briefly talk about what phase one, phase two, phase three mean. Phase one and phase two just mean that the vaccine's currently being tested in a very small group. Very small group in phase one, about 100 people or so in phase two, up to 1,000. And then in phase three, it goes on to many, many more. So the vaccines we currently have available, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, have been tested in 40,000, 35,000, really huge numbers there. And what phase three allows us to do is it helps us to understand what the safety is going to look like, what the rare side effects may look like in these vaccines when used on large scales. That's really what we've been hearing a lot about. 20 vaccines out of those 68 that are currently in clinical trials are pretty far ahead in the phase three as well. Then we have limited vaccines and then the approved vaccines. The approval process is very rigorous, very rigorous. So FDA helps us approve. And then there are also a lot of these vaccine monitoring agencies which help with the approval as well. The Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices from CDC makes recommendations after looking at these approvals or recommendations for emergency use. And then the vaccine is available for use. We have two vaccines that currently have approval for emergency use authorization, which is Moderna and Pfizer. And of those vaccines, one has been abandoned. So what kind of vaccines do we have available? We keep hearing mRNA all the time, and there's always been concern about, okay, this is genetic material. Is it getting incorporated into our genetic material? Actually, no, this is really very safe. And one of the best ways of vaccine production, it's been looked at for a very long time. Now it has been tested. It's safe and pretty efficacious. In fact, very efficacious. What does an mRNA vaccine mean? It has a small genetic component, which is like a messenger from the coronavirus, very short-lived. And that is part of the vaccine. When injected, it does its job of kickstarting the immune system and calling all the first responders to the spot and getting the immune system started. That's one type of vaccine, and that's what we have available so far with the Pfizer and Moderna. The other type of vaccines that we have seen are adenovirus vaccines. Now, this mRNA is extremely fragile, so it needs a lipid core so it can remain stable in the environment, and especially when it is also part of the vaccine and injected into the cells. You want that not to destabilize right away, but you want it to do its job. The lipid layer helps a little bit. A little bit more of a gruff and a stronger version of this structure is an adenovirus-based vaccine. They use a chimpanzee adenovirus, which really doesn't have a potential to cause human infection, but it offers a really strong core for a DNA genetic material for the coronavirus, and it pretty much acts the same. The rest of the pathway is the same. It kickstarts the immune system, and then these things degrade. You can have a protein-based vaccine where proteins which are coalesced and made from probably infecting moths or some other species. And these are very, very similar to what the spike protein looks like, and they can also be used in a vaccine. And the last type of vaccine is the coronavirus, which has been washed or douched multiple times, and this becomes an inactivated variety for causing the same kind of immune response. So you'll see whichever modality is used, it's not a live virus, and it's not the infection. It doesn't have much of a potential to cause infection when used in a vaccine. The mRNA vaccines, when injected into the deltoid, into the arm, very, very short-lived. And that has a messenger to make the spike protein. These red structures are the spike proteins, which are the main proteins found on the structure of the coronavirus. And what it does is it kickstarts the immune system. It calls the first responders, just like we have everywhere. The first responders, the dendritic cells, come in and help with the help of the helper T cells, recruit B cells, which cause the antibody production. And these antibodies, then if there is true infection, they are available to tackle the spike proteins and the coronavirus and protect us. You may wonder how long these antibodies last, how long can they protect us against the coronavirus? These cells also have a way of causing memory for the B cells and the T cells. So the immunity from the vaccine lasts a little bit longer than the natural immunity. In addition to these helper T cells, these first responders also have a more potent killer T cells. So in addition to the antibodies, you have direct attack on the coronavirus with the killer T cells as well. That's a very easy way of how these mRNA vaccines work. You may wonder about the safety and have concerns about the safety because this vaccine has been developed so fast. Vaccine processes can take years usually when you want to make sure that they're safe. The timeline for coronavirus vaccines, the genetic code was identified in January. In March, phase one and phase two of the vaccines were conceived. Phase three was deployed in July. A safety data started to be was available and was started to be analyzed in September. December 11th, ACIP approved and recommended that. FDA said it's okay to have an emergency use authorization from the number of people that we have tested in so far. This is okay. This looks good to be used. So we have the emergency use authorization from FDA and the ACIP recommendations from CDC to use this vaccine. So far, in the United States, we have about 11.9 million doses which have been given. In Illinois, 414, almost half a million doses given. In Sangamon County, we've given 10,000 doses with about 1,000 second doses already that have been given with people who are fully protected. I just want to end with some side effects here. You'll see that allergies was listed as something to be concerned about. CDC came out and said allergies occur in a very, very small percentage. When I say allergies, I'm talking about serious adverse reactions occur in an extremely small percentage of people that receive the vaccine. People who have a history of allergies, seasonal allergies, medication allergies, even adverse reactions to other vaccine products are okay to get this vaccine. The only contraindication is anybody that has an allergy to polyethylene glycol. But otherwise, you'll see that the percentage of side effects that you see with the common side effects, arm swelling, arm redness, arm pain, fatigue, headaches, muscle aches, chills, it's really not bad. If somebody gets fever or chills or muscle aches, that is not the infection, but it's the reactogenicity of the virus. It's a good thing that you're actually starting to develop antibodies from the vaccine. And lastly, we have Pfizer available. We have Moderna available. The efficacy is about 95% or 94%, 94.5%. These are really very efficacious vaccines. You need ultra cold chain storage for Pfizer. For Moderna, you don't need that, but you still need for them to be stored at -8 degrees. Another one which has shown promise is AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca has higher proportion of people who are older or elderly in their trials. It's an inactivated vaccine, different from the mRNA type of vaccines. And that is also quite efficacious. The range is pretty high there. And these are not frozen vaccines. One other group that we are expecting, another vaccine that we're expecting is a Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It's exciting because there's only one dose that's required for that. And that's also in the phase 3 stage at this point.
Should a person who has had COVID and recovered receive the vaccine? And then also, what do we know about those vaccinated transmitting the virus?
Anybody that has had COVID and the natural infection does confer protection. It's not for a very long time. We think up to 3 months or so with natural infection. With the vaccine, the immunity lasts longer. We don't exactly know how long it lasts. There are some studies out of UK that say about 8 months. It could be longer. We're still looking at that. The vaccine immunity definitely lasts longer than the natural infection immunity. It's recommended for anybody with COVID to receive the vaccine, and they can get it anytime their symptoms subside after having COVID. You were asking about transmission. Anybody that receives the vaccine is protected. It's about 95% protected themselves. They still have a chance of carrying the virus in their nasopharynx after exposure. They could potentially expose others who have not been vaccinated. So that is why, at this point, even if the vaccines are given, till you have a good number of people in the community vaccinated, you still want to wear masks. You still want to watch your distance. Still want to wash your hands. The others who have not been vaccinated yet remain protected.
I'd like to bring to the table Heidi Clark now, and it's great that we have her with us to talk about statewide efforts on vaccine allocation and distribution. So Heidi, can you tell us a little bit about the state supply of vaccine and how the Illinois Department of Public Health has thought about the distribution of vaccine and priorities of who gets the vaccine and at what point and when?
We as a state receive currently about 120,000 first doses every week. So that's split into about 60,000 doses of Moderna and 60,000 doses of Pfizer. Currently, that second dose is held back by the federal government, although we've heard both the outgoing administration and incoming administration plan to release those second doses. We're still trying to understand exactly what the federal plan is for doing that. Essentially, we have 120,000 new doses, new first doses coming in each week. Some of that is taken off the top for the long-term care program operated through CVS and Walgreens, and the rest is distributed proportionally according to the size of the priority population group. So up until this point, we've been calculating based on the size of the healthcare worker population by county. Going forward, we're looking at the population groups that are being prioritized in the coming phases. I touched on those priority groups. So the first group is phase 1A. That's defined as paid and unpaid persons working in healthcare settings who may be exposed to COVID. What's important to note there is it's not based on job title. So it's not that we're only looking at doctors and nurses, but really looking at the risk of being in a healthcare facility. So if there's someone who's checking in patients or a security guard that's working in the ED, we want to make sure that they're covered too, because they're at higher risk and the hospitals and healthcare systems need them to stay healthy so that they're able to keep the healthcare system going. Also included in 1A is long-term care settings, so that patients and staff in long-term care facilities. As we move on to 1B, we are including frontline essential workers, which are people who are essential to the functioning of society, and they have no choice but to report directly to work and not work from home. Again, this is a risk-based strategy. Also in this group are first responders, people age 65 and older, and people who are incarcerated. And then the last priority group is 1C, before getting to phase two, which is everybody else. So 1C includes other essential workers, so still folks that are essential to the economy going, but not necessarily having that same risk profile as in phase 1B. And then also included are people aged 16 to 64 with high risk conditions that put them at higher risk of worse outcomes from COVID. We're constantly evaluating and reevaluating how the vaccine rollout is going. If there's any changes, you know, we've been hearing about these new variants of COVID coming into the U.S. If that changes the risk profiles for these groups, there is a chance that the priority groups could change over time. Everything's evolving in COVID. It's been evolving from the beginning, and we want to make sure that we are operating with the most current science, following federal guidance as much as possible.
Could you touch a little bit on the priority order as it relates to the federal versus the state? And, you know, we know that Illinois reduced from age 75 to 65. So can you discuss a little bit of that? And then also, thanks for talking us through how you continue to evaluate and adapt as necessary, and will continue to do so with any challenges that you're seeing on uptake of vaccine. And then lastly, not to throw another question at you, but just touch a little bit on resources that are out there and the data you've just put out on the website with the vaccine and the uptake we're seeing around the state.
The federal guidance coming from ACIP, which is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. I think a lot of folks are getting really familiar with these terms that were kind of just limited to our purview before. ACIP had recommended age 75 and older. They were silent on those who were incarcerated. I found that very disappointing to see from the federal government that they had planned for incarcerated populations. It was encouraged to be included in our planning. They did not prioritize incarcerated populations in their official ACIP guidance. We looked at risk profiles. Again, this is a risk-based strategy. We looked at risk profiles and the fact that folks who are incarcerated have no choice but to be in a congregate setting. And we decided that the right thing to do for Illinois is prioritize that population. As far as the 65 and older versus 75 and older, we made that decision based on an equity lens that we were applying to it. People of color tend to die younger of COVID. And as our whole strategy is to reduce the number of deaths and reduce the impact that COVID is having on all communities, if we kept it at 75 and older, we would be leaving out some of the hardest hit communities with this. So we decided to go down to 65. And then CDC leadership announced earlier this week that they were recommending other states to go down to 65 as well. That wasn't ACIP that made the recommendation. It was the CDC leadership. We were happy to see that they made that recommendation nationwide because we thought it was important to do here and would be happy to see other states follow the same lead. And then as far as data, we're getting close to having administered 500,000 vaccines in Illinois. So that does take into account first and second doses. It doesn't mean that 500,000 individual people have been vaccinated. A real accomplishment to see that in less than a month, we've had that many people vaccinated. More vaccine is arriving daily. We're expecting that vaccinated number to go up and up and up. On average, for the last week, we see about 27,000 vaccines administered statewide daily, which in the last week has been about how many vaccines we've received. The state as a whole is doing a really good job of taking the vaccine that's being shipped and putting it into arms. We're also evaluating if there's a particular provider that's not. We're allocating vaccine elsewhere to make sure that it keeps flowing and get to the Illinoisans that need it. And then just a plug for our vaccine dashboard, if you guys haven't seen it. If you go to bph.illinois.gov/COVID-19, there's a link to the vaccine dashboard that's there. It shows the doses that have been allocated to Illinois, that have been delivered to Illinois, allocated to the long-term care program, and then administered by county. So you can see how various counties are doing in terms of the residents that live there.
I saw a release today against other states. We were about 40%, which is higher than some, but we were right there with all the other states competitively in the rollout. Keep it up. Brian's here to speak with us more specifically on the local front and in the healthcare setting with phase one rollout and administration. So Brian, can you tell us a little bit about your role in handling vaccines for our area and how it's going, what challenges you see? Were you surprised about anything that's happened during the initial phases of the vaccine distribution?
Yeah, a little bit of what we've been doing here. I wear a couple hats here, being the emergency management facilitator at HSH at St. John's, as well as being the coordinator of the Region 3 Healthcare Coalition and the Regional Hospital Coordinating Center. And in that role, we're basically a conduit of information and coordination between the hospitals in our region and the Illinois Department of Public Health. How's it going? It's going very well, actually. Of course, there was a bit of a learning curve at first to make our processes as efficient as possible. We have been making great strides working internally and with our HSHS system office to make those as smooth as possible. Were we surprised? I don't know if we would say we were surprised. There are some logistics that have to be considered when you're vaccinating people with two different manufacturers. Ensuring that you're scheduling properly for return vaccination, and it helps in regard that return vaccinations are on different days for different brands, 21 and 28. So that kind of helps in that process a little bit. So that's one good thing I think that came out of having two different vaccines at the same time.
Regarding the two vaccines, how's the decision about which vaccine's being administered to who? And can a person make that decision about which vaccine they would want locally?
From our clinics that we've run, it's basically what has been delivered initially. It's not really, we don't say which one you want, Moderna or Pfizer, you get a choice. It's whatever is available at the clinic that day.
We know Sangamon County and all the work you're doing with the healthcare system and in phase one, and we know Sangamon County's moving to 1B on Monday and scheduling appointments. Can you discuss a little bit with us those plans and logistics locally?
They do have a process on their website for folks in the particular phase that we're in to go in and sign up. Internally at our facility, we've been taking care of our 1A group, which is everybody in the hospital, but you really have to kind of go back. And when you're talking about vaccinating people within the hospital, you have to make another set of stages. You want to look at your folks that are taking care of in the ER, in the ICU and our COVID floor, as well as those that are helping with that, with our respiratory therapy staff, with environmental services staff, those that are serving those areas also need to be looked at. And then you back away from that as you're looking at patient-facing staff, getting them involved, and then covering the rest of your folks. But as far as the county, I know they've been working real hard this week on first responders as far as EMS, as well as other 1A folks that are like not affiliated with the hospital that has not received the vaccine directly. So I know the county's been working hard on that.
You discussed with us just now a little bit of, you know, identifying those right persons in the healthcare setting, those that have that risk. And, you know, Heidi said it well too, just not by title, but who's most at risk. So can you talk to us a little bit about any challenges you're having with those in the healthcare system, those that can't have the vaccine, actually wanting the vaccine or having it administered and not, especially maybe knowing that over the course of time, right now, it's not mandatory. There's no policy for a COVID vaccine.
it's hard to force somebody to take a vaccine that's been approved through an emergency authorization. But I tell you, we've had a at least internally here, and I know through the county as well, we use Dr. Shelton, who's our medical director for our system. He's been having town hall meetings, the folks in our hospital, in all of our hospitals, talking about the myths and the truths, and trying to get everybody to know the science behind it, just like the Dr. Sundar Shen talked about earlier. And so that's the way we're going about it. And I think that we're looking pretty good. I don't know the definite number right now, but it's a little bit better than what we thought it was going to be as more information comes out. And of course, there's always those people who want to sit back and go, I want to see what happens to the other people first. But I think that they're seeing that. And so that's helpful to us.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, just from the healthcare system and those other facilities, utilizing the chain pharmacies locally and in connection, and then other sites too that in the healthcare system that you're working with as a part of the administration plan locally?
Well, I know that in Sangamon County, you have both Memorial Medical Center and Memorial Health System working on pushing out vaccine, as well as the local health department, as well as HSHS. And as much as we can get vaccine, we're going to be pushing it out to those that in need. I think as you look, as it was discussed earlier, Walgreens, CVS, those other commercial pharmacies, well, they've been contracted through the federal government to vaccinate long-term care and their patients and staff there. But I think they're going to end up being a crucial role player in this to make sure that we're able to get future vaccine distribution to the larger populace. This is a big, huge lift, and it's going to take many people putting shots in arms, not just the health system.
Would you advise persons working in your hospital and working in, you have specific directions to those that are in these phases and where to go to get to have the vaccine, you know, in your facility. But if persons have a choice, if they're in these phases, can you talk us through how they should be making decisions about where to go to get the vaccine, especially as we continue in the phases?
There's going to be a lot of avenues, and making your choice on how that's going to go. It may be through the medical group that you already have a relationship with. It may be that you don't have a relationship with any provider and you go to the county for that. And I think that you're going to see probably across the state a variety of places that people can get it. So I think it may be one place is closer than the other. You know, there's probably a lot of factors that figure into that. But I think pre-established health relationships probably are a big part of that.
You've been in this work for years and years, and there's been a lot of local planning around pandemics, and depending on what the situation is and what the disease we're talking about, around kind of max vaccination clinics. So I just thought maybe you could give us some, as we move through the phases and immunity starts to increase, if we'll adapt our practices from maybe a one-on-one type of appointment approach to other types of approaches for greater vaccine administration, perhaps more efficiency. We're starting to see other areas of the state to have such approaches.
When we started this, it's a whole learning curve, and you're able to make your clinics more efficient. Certainly, drive-through clinics offer that benefit of social distancing. Where walk-in clinics are, you have to be more spread out to ensure social distancing. You got to make sure that you have a sign-in process ready to go that is spaced out. You're going to be asking COVID screening questions for them entering the building like we do every day. You have to have your place set up for post-vaccination wait to make sure you don't have a reaction. So you have to figure out all those processes, whether it's setting up chairs with distancing in a walk-in clinic or having parking spaces available for people to sit in their car and wait for their 15 minutes. I know there's other applications like that we use. It's called MyChart, where we can send out appointments for people that have had a relationship with us to sign up through that. It mimics a lot of what EMTrack is doing for local health departments as far as helping them schedule and then reschedule for the second dose. And then these types of interfaces talk to iCare, which is the state of Illinois' platform for tracking vaccines and how it's and who's receiving it. All those things help make this smoother. And I think the more we're doing it, the better we're going to get.
Dr. McNeese, thanks for being with us today. The COVID pandemic has had a disproportionately adverse effect on African Americans, but there's concerns compared to other populations that they may be less likely to get the vaccine. So as an emergency physician and a pastor of a Springfield church, how do you think about this set of circumstances and what can be done in response, especially through the faith community?
Vaccine hesitancy is real. You can see it throughout the U.S. populations, and it's certainly real among the African-American communities. And the causes of the hesitancy are multifactorial, primarily historical, the result of mistreatment, past mistreatments that lead to current medical mistrust. And I usually think of those in three different forms: racial memories, societal memories, medical memories. And what I mean by that, racial memories are feelings and patterns of thought that are carried down or transmitted down generation to generation. What your great-great-grandma experienced and talked about and told to the children, and now you know about. I believe there's actually a genetic recollection of the trauma that has been carried out on populations such as African-American populations. The societal memories most people know about, things like slavery, segregation, racism, lynchings, predatory lending, second-class education, hate crimes, housing discrimination. But the medical memories are really something that impact Blacks, African-Americans. Most of us African-Americans know about the public autopsy of Joyce Heth in the 1800s and the routine medical experimentation that was done on slaves, like Dr. Sims and the development of the Sims vaginal speculum, World War II mustard gas studies, the co-opting of the Henrietta Lacks HeLa's cell line, and the fact that members of that family have received very little, if any, remuneration from that co-opting. The zinc cadmium sulfide spraying at the Pruitt-Igoe housing complex in St. Louis, the syphilis study at Tuskegee, Holmesburg prism experiments, Mississippi appendectomies, the Flint, Michigan water treatment. All of these things impact African-Americans. They're not only historical memories, but the present day way African-Americans are mistreated when they enter the healthcare system. This leads to vaccine hesitancy. Now, as regards the faith community, I think we should think of the faith community as gifted spiritual women and men who have made faith in God the centerpiece of their life. But they are no less subjected to the same memories as other members of the African-American community. So the solutions are the same. You just, when you're delivering the solutions and the responses, you have to just remember who you're talking to, where you are, why they're there, what is important to them. The most important issue is trust. It's critical. I believe that if you give the African-American community the truth, then you have to stand back and let them make up their own minds.
There's a significant rate of low income among some parts of the local African-American population. How do the effects of being in a low-income household affect vaccine use? Things like not having transportation, having to work multiple jobs, not having a regular, convenient place to receive medical care, childcare challenges, or food availability. And you just went through some of that as it relates to vaccine hesitancy. And then furthermore, and secondary to that, what community and grassroots efforts are underway?
So what you listed were health disparities. Certainly, if you're able to remedy health disparities, that makes things better for people in those populations, and especially people who are in poverty. So yes, if you can eradicate some of those things or improve upon those things, that's going to make the situation best. I know that there are all sorts of people who are working on this issue. I was reading some articles recently about organizations that are trying to speak out about vaccine hesitancy to the African-American community. Workshops that have been held, workshops that are going to be held. I think it is important that people who are trying to eradicate vaccine hesitancy do at least three things. Engage the community well, the African-American community. Educate yourselves and the African-American community. And when you step this off, make sure that it is equitable.
How can we engage and address those that aren't involved in the faith-based community?
No differently. This is a problem for the African-American community. And yes, there are subgroups but no differently. They all want the truth. They all want the information, and then they will take it from there if you engage them. So not only the faith community, but the civic community and the fraternal community and the business community and the entertainment community, all of those communities should be engaged, not just one over the other. And identifying who the leadership is and speaking to that leadership.
To vaccine and safety and effects, are there differences in protective effects or adverse effects of the vaccines in African Americans, Black population compared to other races or ethnicities?
To my knowledge, no.
Speaking to the three E's that you gave us, engage, educate, and make sure equitable. If you could give a charge to this audience as being in the public, what would be your number one action for those of us on the call today with you to help undertake those three E's?
Educate yourself about this vaccine. You know, I've attended workshops where I've learned some things which have been very helpful to me. Even had a conversation with my private physician yesterday where we batted back and forth how I was going to approach this situation because of my own particular comorbidities. So education, if I had to choose something, educate yourself about the vaccine so that you know what's happening and you know it well, and then you can make an informed decision.
Dr. Sundaresan, come on real quickly to help address Dr. McNeese's baton handoff, if you will. So Dr. Sundaresan, if you wanted to address real quickly any adverse effects for different populations, that'd be great to get us going.
I agree with Dr. McNeese. There's really no known difference in efficacy or adverse effects specifically for different groups or different populations. The listed side effects are local reactions, systemic reactions, or allergic reactions. And that's the same pretty much for everybody.
After we and our loved ones are vaccinated, when will we be able to hug again?
We want to get as many people vaccinated as possible. We've heard of herd immunity, H-E-R-D, herd immunity. We anticipate that we want to vaccinate at least 75% of the population for herd immunity. And what that does is it protects us, again, like the variants that we have or people who are unable to get the vaccines. We're able to have that level of protection in the community against the virus. Once we have herd immunity, we can definitely look to let our guards down a little bit and start our steps towards normalcy.
Any idea when more vaccine will become available at Sangamon County? Many of our teachers were unable to get an appointment and have been asking me when they might be able to sign up. So Heidi, can you readdress the approach statewide so people here in Sangamon County and the community understand when volumes will continue and how that works?
We get more allocation every week to the state, and that's allocated proportionally across the state population. We are looking into, we've already started, but trying to do it a little more in an organized fashion, making sure that areas that have been hit particularly hard by COVID are receiving more vaccine to get their community more vaccine coverage. Generally, shipments go to local providers, whether that's the local health department or hospitals or other providers, every week. That's as we're getting them in from the federal government, getting them from the manufacturers. At this point, really, the slowdown is in manufacturing. I know there's a lot of concerns about political influences, and I'm sure that that plays a part into some of this. For the most part, it's a limit in the supply chain, and as more vaccines are approved, as these companies figure out how to scale up production, we should expect to see more in Illinois.
Can you discuss with us right now, the providers have been mainly the health departments and the hospitals receiving. Can you talk us through the phases and how, and should the public anticipate doctor's offices receiving vaccine doses in addition to those that we're seeing right now so that they too can help administer?
Sure. So one of the things that we're expanding to right now is in the next couple of weeks, expanding to more pharmacies. So right now, CVS and Walgreens are vaccinating the long-term care facilities, but there's a federal retail pharmacy partnership. Through that, we're able to transfer some of our state's allocation to these pharmacies, and they distribute amongst their stores as directed by IDPH. We are engaging with as many of the partners that the federal government has as quickly as possible. I think Walgreens will be the first to come online for providing vaccines more broadly in their stores. But we're also looking at the other chain pharmacies to have big picture agreements with and transfer doses to their chain network. Now, Molly knows this. I live in a very rural part of the state that doesn't have the advantage of having any kind of chain pharmacy or really an expansive health network at all. So we do have providers in every state or in every county of the state. We're looking at what providers do we have, what populations are they serving? And if that's not sufficient, we're doing provider outreach. Obviously, we want to have as many providers on board as possible. But given the fact we're going through all of our vaccines very quickly, that may take some time to bring on additional private independent doctor's offices as we're really focusing on what the local health departments are doing. Hospitals have been supporting a really tremendous portion of the early phase of the response. The pharmacies are coming on board next.
Brian, do you have anything local to add around tagging with Heidi's reaching kind of more the rural aspects of the county?
There are areas of our state that are very underserved by healthcare, and several counties that don't have a local health department are being covered by another local health department, may not even have a clinic or a hospital. Getting to those people is going to be important.
We have a more specific question around eligible healthcare workers that have declined vaccination, and if we know and have learned their reason and rationale for declination.
So from the state perspective, we don't have a great way of collecting those data except through survey data. So we did add on a question to our behavioral risk factor surveillance system starting last August, which was before the vaccine was actually approved and available. So we know that acceptance and willingness to get the vaccine is changing. For some folks, it's going up. They're more likely to accept, and some folks are less likely to accept. We're looking into ways to get more timely data. What we saw from that survey is what we suspected that we would see, that the people who identify as Black or Latinx were less likely to say they would want to get the vaccine. Also, all of downstate, regardless of rural versus more urban area downstate, all of downstate was less likely to say that they would be willing to get the vaccine. We saw higher willingness to get it in the color counties among white populations and older populations.
I am looking at the Sangamon County vaccination plan. They have projections through, I think, the end of March going forward. So how long do we anticipate getting to phase two?
It'll probably take some time. Drew out just back of the envelope math on different scenarios, and it's really dependent on when these additional vaccine candidates come online. If Johnson & Johnson comes online in February, they said that they plan to complete their data analysis from their phase three trials sometime in February. They could have an EUA approved sometime February or March, and that would speed things up tremendously, much, much faster. Either way, no matter what scenario we're looking at, it will be at some point this year we're seeing phase two. We can expand manufacturing capacity if we're getting all of the doses proportionally allocated to us without anything happening at the federal level. Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca come on board, we could see it very quickly. But with our current 120,000 doses per week, it's going to take some time.
For long-term care facilities, we know that vaccines being administered to those facilities and there's a pharmacy partner program that's helping do that. Can we address locally the long-term care facilities and administration? And then also from a data perspective, can we clarify if the data doses that are on both the IDPH website dashboard and the Sangamon County dashboard, if those include long-term care facilities?
Our dashboard is updated twice weekly with the long-term care specific administration numbers. So our total at the top of the dashboard that says the number of vaccines administered, that's the number of vaccines administered in any setting in Illinois, long-term care or otherwise. Below that, you'll see the number of vaccines administered in long-term care facilities. That's a subset of the overall number, and that is only updated twice weekly because that's the reporting requirement for CVS and Walgreens to the federal government. Unfortunately, one of the great things about the partnership is that we get to be a little hands-off and we can focus our energies on getting the vaccine elsewhere. On the other side of that coin, because we're more hands-off, we don't have that immediate data that we might if they were state providers.
Brian or Dr. Sundarshan, do you have any added information for long-term care in the Springfield-Sangamon community?
There is, of course, the vaccination has started. We don't know exactly how many people have been vaccinated in the long-term care facilities, but Walgreens and CVS, a lot of the vaccination for the long-term care is undertaken by Walgreens and CVS. From what I hear, it's going pretty well. Some of the nursing homes, some of the assisted living, these are the two groups for long-term or congregate care that are covered with the vaccination plan for the congregate setting and long-term care. Independent living and rehab are not. So we're trying to get more clarification on that. But definitely the assisted living as well as the nursing homes, they are getting it. They're directly contacting for the vaccines. It's not mediated through the health department.
I can't thank you all, panelists, enough for your dialogue here and your education to the public.